You ask, what is our policy? I will say, it is to wage war by sea, land, and air, with all our might, with all the strength that God can give us, to wage war against a monstrous tyranny never surpassed in the dark and lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word, victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be. For without victory there is no survival.
When it finally happened, May the 7th and 8th almost merged into one. The 7th was by far the most hectic. Churchill was expected to speak at 6 p.m, then cancelled it. Great anticlimax. Then at midnight, I heard that Eisenhower at Schaeff had asked for the use of the start point transmitter in a few hours' time. Start point in Cornwall would be used for any big announcement. As I had a bed at the BBC, I rolled into it at 2:30 a.m. and was woken at 4. I rang announcer Frank Phillips and told him to get the keys of the safe at Bush House. In it were records of victory messages from heads of state such as de Gaulle and Queen Wilhelmina, all prepared in advance for the great moment. Word of VE Day came early by telephone from number 10. I don't remember feeling elated. I just thought, thank God it's over. Programs ran normally till 3 p.m. when I went to the microphone and said, "This is London. The Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Winston Churchill." His voice came in, relayed from our studio at Storey's Gate. At 9, I announced the King, who spoke from Buckingham Palace, and then we did the victory report, with pre-recorded messages from the various service chiefs. At 10:45, when broadcasting ended, I was summoned by Sir William Hayley, the Director General, to his office for a glass of sherry. He dug it out of his cupboard. Afterwards, I went up to the roof of Broadcasting House. London was a blaze of light. And I thought, good heavens, it's my birthday. I'm 41. Everyone else is busy getting drunk, and I'm stone cold sober.
Yesterday morning, at 2:41 a.m., at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied Expeditionary Force and simultaneously to the Soviet High Command. The German war is therefore at an end. After years of intense preparation, Germany hurled herself on Poland at the beginning of September 1939. Finally, almost the whole world was combined against the evildoers, who are now prostrate before us. But let us not forget for a moment the toils and efforts that lie ahead. Japan, with all her treachery and greed, remains unsubdued. We must now devote all our strength and resources to the completion of our tasks, both at home and abroad. Advance Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom! God save the King!
I was serving with the 12th Lancers in the desert. It was just before the Battle of Alamein. As long as I had a compass, I could find my way anywhere in the desert. One day, I pushed ahead in a jeep with half a dozen others to see where the enemy forces lay. We climbed a hill in the Katara Depression, and at the top ran smack into an enemy outpost. Luckily, the Germans had taken their shirts off and were sunbathing. Their weapons were nowhere within reach, so we reversed and drove hastily away. There were shouts and bullets began whistling round us. But we made it back to camp, and a day or so later, Monty happened to visit us. The CO told him the story, and I was pointed out to him. The next day, there was a message from Monty, offering me a job as his ADC. We completely failed to hit it off, so much so that I told Monty he ought to find a replacement. He agreed with almost too much enthusiasm. Then came a trip back to Cairo for 24 hours leave. Monty told me to join him at the airstrip the following day, where he would inspect the guard before we took off. I went with another officer to Cairo Zoo. At the elephant's enclosure, the other chap whipped off my cap and offered it to Jumbo. He snatched it with his trunk and promptly ate it. Well, not quite all of it. He spat out the 12th Lancer's cap badge with considerable disgust. I could hardly inspect the guard with Monty when not properly dressed. So I sneaked into the plane the next day after the rest of the party was aboard. The field marshal was furious. "How dare you disobey my orders?" he hissed. I told him the elephant story. He looked at me a little oddly and said nothing. I resumed driving him through the desert in his open Humber. One day he said, "About that elephant, your excuse was so ridiculous that you couldn't possibly have made it up." A wintry smile flickered round those blue-green eyes. The ice was broken, we got on fine after that, and I stayed with him. I've never told anyone that story. I can't think what made you ask me about it.
One day the whole of Albury School was mustered at the top of New Road Hill to wave our Union Jacks at a VIP who was coming to review the Canadian troops stationed in Albury Park. I was so excited as I thought I would at last see King George VI in the flesh. The little man in the large black beret sitting in the back of the Rolls Royce was such a disappointment to me that I could hardly wave my flag. He even spoke to us as we stood beside the row, but I cannot remember what he said. I was too young to know that this was Field Marshal Montgomery of Alamein, and I was looking at history in the making. Those same Canadian troops were our great friends. They hung over the park railings as we walked home from school, giving us chewing gum and candy and talking in that strange foreign accent. Field Marshal Montgomery was known for his more or less impromptu morale-boosting review of troops. The review on Albury Heath was obviously one such event.
The job is not unlike that of a fighter pilot. Each day one goes out on a sortie, probably 200 miles, in a jeep. You force your way through columns of tanks, driving on the pavements of towns, heeding no signs from the military police or no entry notices. It becomes exhausting in the battle areas. I was held up yesterday in a column of tanks near Wellsen. The woods were ablaze, the noise of tanks, the bark of anti-tank guns, and here and there a dead horse, swollen and bloated, with its legs jutting stiffly into space, like an overturned wooden horse. The air filled with smoke and impenetrable dust. Then, nearer the battle, that special silence that means danger, and the absence of vehicles, or perhaps tanks deployed along edges of woods, and the savage clatter of gunfire. You see huddled corpses, shattered lorries and tanks, with clothing and litter hanging on the trees, as though a Christmas tree decorated with death. Then home again, black with dust. A wash outside one's tent in the field, but very difficult to get clean. Marking the Field Marshal's map is the first priority, and, if there is time, marking the Ops map and dictating a log. Dinner may be before or after seeing the CNC. In the peace of the caravan, one relates to Monty what one has done. Monty sits back in his chair, facing the map on which you are demonstrating. He wears a grey zip jacket and a duffel coat. He emits little high-pitched grunts. And he listens with an intentness and responsiveness extraordinary in such a senior commander.
Normandy, July the 19th, 1944. I eat in a tent and live in a chateau. The aged Duke and his wife have a few rooms to themselves and potter about the garden, rather lost among the airmen, soldiers, tents and jeeps. Last Sunday morning I was roused from a deep sleep by him singing. From my bedroom window I looked down on a service around the lily pond. General Montgomery read the lesson, the parable of the Good Samaritan, in his clipped headmaster's voice. The padre's sermon was poor. The wonderful élan, the laughter and comradeship of the troops ad nauseam. War is very different from my imagination of it. There is no front, only a field that might be hiding snipers, villages still unbroken. Guns are thumping all day. Nearer, you hear machine gun fire. Roads are congested everywhere with endless convoys throwing up clouds of acrid, choking dust. The countryside reminds me somewhat of the Cotswolds, the same mellow stone, orchards, wheat fields. The peasants carry on as they can, their villages mutilated, cornfields scarred by tanks. But they wave and smile, and a publican will take you into a back room for a glass of Calvados or wine. War is more than anything else a terrible, squalid business. On the wireless or in a paper it appears clear-cut, a question of strategy, gains and losses. Here you see files of hangdog prisoners. Churches, farmhouses, cottages, mined and passed over, where tanks have come to grips and men died by the hundred. You see a field lined with fresh graves, wooden crosses with only a name and regiment, and behind a screen, dead men, bound in blankets, awaiting the padre. Nearer the front, you steer clear of a house or wrecked tank around which clings the loathsome sweet smell of death. That is one side. The contrast is here too. The corn is being reaped. A milkmaid crosses a field with a pail and stool. A water carrier leads his oxen. Boys fish in a stream. At this moment, from the village across the fields, comes the clang of the church bell. That is the life, thank God, that will go on. I must come back here one day to walk country roads on which only a trap or hay wain passes, drink wine in the cafe of a quiet village where sounds are country sounds and the scars of war have healed. War cannot be read about, it must be seen. Because death over here is a commonplace, lasting things increase in significance. The mind reaches back for a firmer faith.
I have learned that a good lawn costs money. It needs spring dressing, autumn dressing, deworming, preventatives against disease, clover and moss, and all the rest. It is mown twice a week when the grass is growing strongly, in a normal year from early May onwards. The blades of my lawn mower are set fairly high. One does not want to shave a lawn. It is best to mow often, taking off a little grass each time and never allowing it to get long and coarse. The lawn is never rolled. The weight of the mower is enough. Worms are absolutely forbidden. You cannot have a good lawn if they are allowed to intrude. Moles are also forbidden. We have become expert at catching any which think they would like to hunt on my island. If there are no worms, there are no moles, since worms are their food. Nor is there a single weed in that 800 square yards of lawn. If one does appear, it is immediately pulled out by hand. One man alone could not cope with it all. It needs two, a gardener and a garden boy. For myself, I plan and issue orders. My actual contribution to work is with a pair of secateurs, clipping and seeing the shrubs and plants get the light and plenty of sun and do not overgrow each other. In a garden, one must never let up. Once you do, nature takes over, and then you are really in trouble.
He clearly kept the flower beds and lawns under the eye of some arboreal sergeant major, who had strict orders to put them in the guardhouse instantly if a weed should spring up in the wrong place, or a leaf should fall where it's not supposed to be. I've never seen anything done with such meticulousness and order.
Last time I spoke to you, I quoted the lines of Longfellow which President Roosevelt had written out for me in his own hand. I have some other lines, which are well known, but which seem apt and appropriate to our fortunes tonight. And I believe they will be so judged wherever the English language is spoken or the flag of freedom flies. For while the tired waves vainly breaking seem here no painful inch to gain, far back through creeks and inlets making comes silent flooding in the main. And not by eastern windows only, when daylight comes in the light. In front the sun climbs slow, how slowly, but westward, look, the land is bright.
Almost the best thing about D-Day was that we were getting rid of the Americans, at last. They lit fires in barns, dug slit trenches in cornfields, littered the country with live ammunition and drank the pubs dry. Without them, we could have had a nice, quiet war. They even shot at us to make us jump. I'm not joking, they really did. And so careless with their equipment, they left their boots, ammunition boxes, even their trousers everywhere. One day an officer came to see me, saying his troops had lost so many clothes, had I seen any of them? I didn't like to tell him we always kept anything we found. Only after he had left did I realize I was wearing an American Army pullover. No wonder he was looking at me so suspiciously. I wasn't a very good air raid warden, you know. The stirrup pump they issued clogged up completely after I used it to whitewash the cowsheds. As chairman of the parish council, I helped arrange a special winter's evening service in the church for the scouts. A terrible thought struck me during one of the hymns. I had all the lights blazing and I was doing nothing about it. In the early days of the war, there were rehearsals for a German invasion. Headquarters would ring me at night and say it was a red alert. I said, look, I work hard all day for the war effort and I'm not turning out at night, even for Germans. I threatened to take the phone off the hook if they persisted, so they stopped. I spent much of VA day dressed as an old gaffer with straws in my hair in the decorated vehicles competition. Our lorry won first prize of 5 shillings. I remember how the sun shone and how we climbed to the top of the beacon to light a bonfire. We were so happy it was all over. All through the war, I had been using German prisoners of war to help with the harvest. It was awful when they went home. I had to buy a combined harvester.
President Roosevelt has recently made it clear that he would like to discuss with us and with the Dominion of Canada and with Newfoundland the development of American naval and air facilities in Newfoundland and in the West Indies. Undoubtedly, this process means that these two great organizations of the English-speaking democracies, the British Empire and the United States, will have to be somewhat mixed up together in some of their affairs for mutual and general advantage. For my own part, looking out upon the future, I do not view the process with any misgivings. I could not stop it if I wished. No one can stop it. Like the Mississippi, it just keeps rolling along. Let it roll on, full flood, inexorable, irresistible, benignant, to broader lands and better days.
Bending resolve of the British nation.